Welcome to this edition of Cover to Cover with me, Eusebius Makaiser, as the anchor for this week's edition of the show. We've got a range of different books, two of them political and in a sense also social by nature, and the other one equally political but a different genre. A little bit later in today's show, Jacques Rousseau, who is a critical thinking lecturer at the University of Cape Town and also a philosopher, he reviews the book written by Helen Ziller that is a critique of woke politics, and I'm looking forward to hearing what Jacques has to say about Helen Ziller's latest book. I'm currently reading, but I won't be reviewing today, a book that is almost adjacent to that, at least insofar as both of them were former DA leaders, and it is Future Tense, Reflections on My Troubled Land by Tony Leon. So in a future edition of the show, watch out for my review, my full review of this book. It's been a fascinating read. But we're going to start today's show by playing you a recording of an interview I did of a really beautiful poetry anthology that is edited by Wamui Mbao, who, in my opinion, must be one of the top two or three critical essayists in this country when it comes to book journalism specifically. And this anthology is a really, really interesting attempt to decolonize poetry, and it is one of those books that will make you probably regrets not falling in love with poetry earlier. This is how the conversation went.
Congratulations on compiling it and on a brilliant introduction to it as well. In a country where we don't have enough of a reading culture, I think this book, although it includes poems before the present, is special in part because there are also so many young people whose ideas and creativity are rendered visible. So well done on it.
Thank you so much, Eusebius. I really appreciate that. The book is definitely a labor of love, so I'm glad that it's finally out in the world and doing work.
My first question to you is whether poetry in South Africa also needs to be decolonized, and what is meant by poetry that is decolonization poetry?
I think that when we talk about poetry of decolonization or decolonization poetry, we're trying to think about poetry that's doing a certain kind of work in the world, and that has to do with shifting meanings around, you know, people and how we live our lives that don't necessarily fit us anymore, that don't necessarily gel with us at either at a political or a social level. Decolonization is a very, you know, difficult word to sometimes unpack because it comes with so much meaning. As soon as you put it down on the table, you have so much that you need to kind of think through. So in this collection, I've tried to think about, you know, this concept of decolonial poetry as poetry that does political work, poetry that speaks about liberation from various forms of subjugation, and to think about that as a kind of creative work in the world, you know, how we might engage with, you know, this sort of creative archive of both past and present works that think about how to imagine a different kind of world.
And poetry is not neutral, right? Because I've always thought, and I know far too little about poetry, and you've made me excited again to not be scared to understand it as a form, although fewer words go into a poem than a novel or a work of nonfiction, it has always struck me as a technically harder discipline to appreciate as a reader or as an audience member in the spoken poetry circuit. And so I've had some trepidation going there, but these poems are very accessible. But to the extent that I've bothered thinking about poetry philosophically, I've always been something of a subjectivist, that there's not much to be said about poems. Poems are merely subjective expressions of the poet's worldview. But you write in your introduction something really interesting that made me think, aha, you need to think a bit more carefully about poetry. Poetry is not all that innocent, Eusebius. And you had the following to say: poetry is not neutral. It is, in fact, deeply structured by the same biases and beliefs that undergird structural inequalities. What do you mean by that?
I think what I'm getting at there is that, you know, poetry is, you know, as with other forms of creative writing or creative work in the world, just another form of expressing meaning, you know, expressing a particular kind of meaning about who you might happen to be or what you happen to see or believe or whatever you want to bring across. And in that sense, it is deeply, you know, underwritten by the systems of knowledge that shape our lives. You know, poetry is an embodied form of you know, something that you put out into the world, and as with any other form of creative work, it's shaped by what you have experienced in the world. What, and that experience then, you know, alters or informs what you then bring to the public. And so when I was thinking about, you know, the various poems that came together here, I think the thing that constantly came back to me was that these are poems that speak about certain kinds of experience that we might collectively call, you know, a South African experience, a South African political experience. And those experiences are varied, they are deeply subjective, they are often very deeply personal, but they come together in a way that then tells us something about ourselves and about our country and our political heritage and landscape that we might term South African.
I think that's true. The other point you made in the introduction is that there isn't an innocence about who is considered mainstream, for example. And I thought to myself, okay, so this is part of the point, and I get it, and it is important, and that part of the decoloniality work to be done in relation to poetry is also whose poetry gets taught, what are in the syllabi at schools and within universities, for example, what makes a so-called classic anthology, who does or doesn't make a Chapman anthology, for example, and I never thought about that. And you took me back to university where I had an excellent classmate who majored in English. And I remember her scoffing one day at nervous conditions when it came up in a discussion and said that it's not real literature. All it really is anthropology, pretending to be a real work of fiction. And that is the kind of attitude that you're trying to pick out, right?
Yes, very definitely. I mean, I think that, again, on a very simple level, my engagement with poetry starts from, you know, very much as you said earlier, I'm someone who comes to poetry with a sense of anxiety. Do I really understand everything that's going on there? This is not something that is necessarily what I would necessarily go to first and foremost if I'm looking for that kind of creative output. And then I wanted to unpack, okay, but why do I have that reaction? Why, what informs that response? And for a lot of us who do have that response, it goes back to the poetry that we encountered at school,
university,
you know, and you think, okay, well, I mean, if poetry, and you say the word poetry and it conjures Wordsworth or T.S. Eliot or all of these things, then you're going to have a particular kind of response to it. And that response might be off-putting because, you know, for various reasons. And I mean, I remember arriving as a first-year student at Rhodes University, UCKR, and being handed this massive sheaf of poems, you know, called of Time, you know, and having to go through, you know, you wade through Beowulf and Shakespeare, all of this stuff before.
Oh, God, you should have said trigger warning. I went through the same first year English, even though I had a really, really good tutor who's now, I think, even a doctor, if not professor, Debbie Seddon, who did the most to try and ameliorate the process. But you're right. It assaults you. It's an aesthetic assault, quite apart from the intellectual trepidation. Even if you come armed with an A in English from a trick.
Exactly that. You find yourself on ground which feels very uncertain. And I think, you know, revisiting it 15 years after the fact for me, I was struck by, okay, but maybe there is something more in that anxiety that we need to unpack. And that goes to, you know, what is it that we consider poetry?
And well, listen, in the time that we have left, why don't we show rather than tell and read some poems. And by the way, because the meta issue we're discussing is fascinating, but I think it'll be better with reference to poems. One of the weird things that one has to work on in oneself coming to this anthology is to not think that it's less than the turgid Shakespearean stuff because it's accessible.
Yes.
Suddenly you go like, oh my God, but if I can understand what this person is saying, it's not really poetry. Poetry is meant to be impenetrable. And a lot of these poems are not, both in terms of style and structure and subject matter. And then there is the contrarian in me that wants to go, no, man, this looks like diary entry shorthand, which speaks precisely to those intellectual biases and the templates that we swallow whole about what counts as poetry.
Yes.
What's the first one you're going to read? Maybe a poem that will give a sense of where the title Years of Fire and Ash come from. Introduce us to it and then go for it.
Cool. I'm going to read a poem called 1976. It's by Opa Tandom Timkulu, and I think it's the sort of masthead poem of this collection, and I think it really encapsulates exactly what's going on here. 1976. Go, 1976. We need you no more. Never come again. We ache inside. Good friends we have lost. 1976, you stand accused of deaths, imprisonments, exiles, and detentions. You lost the battle. You were not revolutionary enough. We do not boast about you. Year of fire, year of ash. That's a poem which it's so resonating on so many levels. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. And one of the beautiful things you do, which, again, we don't have time for year, but I want to honor you, and then we'll move to the next poem. Curating and editing and putting together poems is a complicated art that I appreciated while reading this anthology. Do you arrange them thematically, chronologically? What gets excluded? And I love how nerdishly academic you are by apologizing like a good PhD does. I'm so sorry for what I left out. This is not the last time we can do this. A future edition will include your other faves.
One must always be hopeful.
And the other point you make is that there are classic poems we were taught, even in matric, like A White Christmas, for example, some Chris van Wyk, which, if you arrange them in a new anthology in conversation with young people, take on new meaning.
Yeah,
there's one that I'm not going to get to about the miners, for example, that is a classic poem chronicling the experiences of mine workers. And suddenly, in conversation with Marikana and the present, it takes on new shades. So congratulations from a curating point of view. Sometimes people think it's easy to be an editor. All you're doing is Googling and then putting stuff in an anthology. I think you did really, really well. So I want to read, how do I say Khadija's surname? And if you're watching Khadija, my apologies. Brilliant, brilliant poem, Citizen Miners.
Khadija Higa, it's a fantastic poem.
I want to read it a little bit. It's the only one I'm going to read. And then I will leave our editor to read you one more, and then you must go and buy the book, and then we'll have another conversation after you've had a taste of more of these poems. They're just so stunning. Suffering has a black skin. How am I to be now that I am made of glass and words have no sound except for those uttered in the past? Sometimes I'm black when politics parodies a truth and quantity is kin. Sometimes I am black. Sometimes only in the vaguest sense do I have a history, a memory, a cultural reality. Easier to keep me in the dark, easier to talk about the Indian Ocean slave trade as if it were one of the stepsisters, easier to say that I almost suffered, and almost one thing, not quite another. Somewhere between here and there, between 1994 and the present, I was lost on the periphery of a South African story, because if memory serves, the historical themes, it seems, my people were never participants in the resistance, never marched, never fought, never died. Colored anomaly, forcibly removed, survivors of slave ancestry, the sum total of my past coined thus, and by the degree I'm not so bad off progeny. We won't omit you completely. We'll just play with the lighting so it won't look so frightening. Pieces of a story, just enough said, so you'll go quietly to bed. Citizen, not quite black. Ek is mos verkoop teen my manskap, a government wat alweer praat van equality and freedom, maar hier is die ding. Die vinger wys verby daar waar ek bly, is hy so bad offie, maak nie saak hoeveel gangsters en drug addicts daar is hy. Ek kom nie van die struggle en is by definition not defined as an apartheid crime. Citizen, was hy daar nie, mag hy klaar nie, frek van pille roek met 'n apartheid spook. And now 18 years later, left with a democratic hangover and a negotiated new South Africa, I find that not an apartheid crime, ruining the length and breadth of mostly colored youth, filling the gap between yesterday and today with a smell not unlike that of the underdog. Unity and diversity becomes a travesty if we omit just one you see, but history, it seems, is a commodity, something dressed for a particular emphasis sold to the appropriate buyer. But it's not that simple, they tell me. There are complexities, if you please. Don't oversimplify. Is it complex to lie, make over, storyboard edit, till you don't see the one slipping through the cracks? Until suffering has one color and prosperity another, and I become the pain you see through now that I am made of glass and the skeleton of my ancestors can be seen in the faces of the young. We carve a dubious future at best, but I, like a ghost, will not rest until equal means what it is and recognition is fair and suffering has no color until I have no more goose flesh in these modern day prisons of freedom for all, where we create more underdogs for the next struggle. Hoe kom gat ons daar in 'n blind hoek vasgevang, gemang deur 'n fucked up van understanding of identity? Hoe fair aluta, hoe fair continua? Ek is mos verkoop teen my manskap, a government wat alweer praat van equality and freedom, maar hier is die ding, die vinger wys verby daar waar ek bly. Is hy so bad offie, maak jy saak hoeveel gangsters en drug addicts daar is hy, dat kom jy van die struggle, and is by definition not defined as an apartheid crime. Citizen, was hy daar nie, mag hy klaar nie, frek van pille roek met 'n apartheid spook. I find that poem really painful because it speaks to struggles between black and brown peoples that in part it's really fucked up and is a win for white supremacy. And it makes me think of the work in part of Nathan Trantal, Oorlog and his anthology. And I chose to read that one for all the obvious reasons, because we are so black and white and reductive. Why did you think it was important for you to include it?
I think because it was such a deeply affecting poem in that regard, because it speaks so clearly to a long and continuing history of oppression that extends in so many directions. And that also then, you know, gets us to think in you know, productive and you know, to inhabit particular kinds of spaces around these concepts or these ideas of identity that we have when we call ourselves black or when we call ourselves brown or colored or this, that, you know, there's so much going on there.
Absolutely.
And Khadija has a wonderful way of getting to the heart of that in very poetry.
Stunning. Please go and buy the book, Years of Fire, South African Poems of Decolonization, Years of Fire and Ash. It's a beautiful collection, and I can't wait to talk more with the editor about it. But Mui, you put together a beautiful, beautiful collection. we're going to outro with an important theme. We're not there yet. Misogynoir is one of the biggest injustices in the world that continue phenomenologically, politically, linguistically. And this book begins to fight back by allowing Black women to own the stupid tag of being angry and militant just because they find their voice. What's the last poem? You're not going to analyze it. You're going to read it, and we'll leave it to hang in the air.
The last poem is a love poem to the problematic Black woman. Pulang, by Pulang Langa Stewart. Aggressive? No, she said. Undressing her in her sixth tongue, redressing her with bland understandings of unilingualisms which have never truly acknowledged the five other skins wrapped snugly around her ability to create meaning. Instead, young and Black and female and loud, quick time translate into aggression, belying the intricate complexities which weave together the inflections of her Xhosa, intonations of her Pedi, the imperatives of her Shangani, all squeezed into the eloquence of her English. See, she knows her privilege. When she speaks, words with none of the long, elongated vowels no one else seems able to say without subconsciously making fun. Aggressive? Asked the girl with long natty locks and a Biko gospel. No. Passionate about those uncomfortable English words, the loud ones, the impolite ones that challenge a status quo which keeps the other five tongues in cages, flicking the one you listen to in shapes that abandon, that conjure up images of an abandoned revolution, the body count of monopolized social evolutions. Aggressive? No. Angry, she says, and far less than she should be or could be, because look beneath you. You're still standing on the same land, for now, living lives built on stolen time. My mother was a kitchen girl. My father was a garden boy. That's why I'm a socialist. I'm a socialist. I'm a socialist, she sings. And come, scoff. Please, scoff and tisk and click tongues. Clutch your pearls at the palpable burning rage of today in the wake of a not even slightly bloodless transition, still claiming casualties, and the people shall share in the wealth of the land. See, I understand how funny this must seem when it appears outside a Freedom Charter meme, because the practicalities of equality were never supposed to be so extreme. Instead, somewhere, at some point, a few generations down the line, money will drip down into the right hands, having slipped out enough car windows to enough car guards, because the egalitarian nature of neoliberal capitalism just works that way, and privilege is naturally inclined to give itself up without a fight. And then, yes, young Black female, be aggressive, bare your teeth, be the bane of polite conversation, ruin dinner parties, lecture theatres, and all other spaces built only to tolerate you with the aggressive insertion of yourself. The wholeness of you, the Blackness of you, the curve and dip and rage of you as an extending site of struggle. Bang at the gates. Make them all bear witness to the wounds so actively unlooked at. Brandish them and say, I have not forgotten you, and you shall not forget me, though in noble attempts to nullify this history. Be aggressive with those uncomfortable words. Rage in all those tongues.
Thank you.
And that, of course, was Dr. Mbav with this fantastic anthology that I hope that many of you will go out and buy. Well, in this next segment, if you don't plan to read Helen Ziller, someone else has done it on your behalf, Jacques Rousseau. Let's have a listen to what he thought of this book.
This is a brief review of Helen Ziller's new book, published in late April 2021, titled Hashtag Stay Woke, Go Broke, and subtitled Why South Africa Will Not Survive America's Culture Wars and What You Can Do About It. To some extent, it's one of those cases where I read it so that you don't have to, although I'm sure a lot of you, or a lot of people at least, will be looking forward to reading it. This isn't to say the book isn't interesting, but perhaps not for the reasons that Helen Ziller would hope for. It captures all of the stereotyping and superficial analysis and conservative paranoia that those of us who keep an eye on the kind of anti-woke brigade, especially on social media, the people who rail against things like cultural Marxism, have watched evolve for quite a few years now. And to say that these offensive things that people rail against on Twitter, such as cultural Marxism and wokeness, are not a problem would be false. There is a sense in which they do result in unnecessarily polarized debate, in which people are cast out of jobs or out of society or certain circles of society because they are misrepresented, because their speech is silenced and so forth. That certainly is a problem, but the solution to that problem is not to go completely in the other direction and to stereotype anybody who believes in something besides a kind of conservative norm of identity and of what the limits of speech are and so forth should be labeled as woke or should be trivialized or demeaned. And the book does a lot of that. It does a look of a lot of slurring or mischaracterization of its opponents. Ziller and her defenders are going to say that I'm mischaracterizing the book, so of course you should read it for yourself. And this is one of those strange books to review as well, because those people who agree with her concerns are going to call me woke, or are going to call any critics of the book woke. They're going to view this as a kind of apologia for wokeness itself, and other people who think that the more conservative element are a blight on society are going to think that I am not being rude enough about the book. But of course, I always like to find a middle ground and a fair way of approaching things rather than joining in the kind of mobbing of one side or another. The criticism in the book takes pains to note that the voices on Twitter and people shouting each other on Twitter are not representative of majority sentiment. But the examples that are drawn in this book and also in much of the online commentary on these topics often relies on cherry-picked examples rather than a holistic picture of the territory that is being surveyed. Outside of social media, it's actually pretty rare to find the sorts of things that are complained about in this book as being broadly manifested in society. It's easy to find particular examples, but particular examples are not enough to make the general case. They're very memorable, so they help to tell a story. So in this book, you'll find examples like that. You might recall the UCT student a few years back who made some claims about lightning that were patently false and also quite absurd. But the fact is that a 19-year-old who is politically exuberant or passionate about something at a particular time at the university where everybody is, in a sense, in a heightened state of political tension is not representative of what goes on at universities in general. The fact that a university such as mine, the University of Cape Town, might invite a speaker or two who are also capable of being criticized on these sorts of grounds does not mean that that same attitude seeps through the entire university. It does not mean that there isn't internal criticism of that sort of attitude. And it certainly doesn't mean that the humanities, as these people like to say, that the humanities in general are bastions of cultural Marxism, postmodernism, wokeness, and all of those sorts of things. So that's the first problem, is that the premise that we have these breeding grounds of wokeness is simply not true. And secondly, we would also need to say that even if we were training such people, that they are in such positions of influence or power in society that they get to potentially destroy a nation. That is also not the case. The main academic argument that Helen Ziller tries to mount is that it's critical race theory that is being taught, that personal identity and objective assessments of it are not possible, that people can define themselves as they like, and that this attitude has indirectly led to people being able to, in a sense, gaslight us in political ways and persuade us that one cannot criticize things. And meanwhile, state capture happens. Meanwhile, the state coffers get looted and so forth. And that's how the book becomes a defense of a political point of view and an opportunity to bash the ANC and to bash people like Musi Maimane and to do some praise singing for Zilla's version of liberalism. So I'm not going to go into a detailed disagreement or agreement with individual chapters or statements in the book. My comments here are a general comment on the structure and the tone of the book and its basic premise and argument. Other people can be more specific about their criticisms if they like, but my general concern is that the book is as reductionist as the concept it purports to address. It would support exactly the same binary analysis as Zilla is purportedly concerned with in writing the book. So in summary, if you want your biases about the woke confirmed, then you'd presumably love the book. If you want your biases about Helen Zilla confirmed, then I think you would also love the book. But if you want a nuanced analysis of things like the culture wars, which aren't a new thing, I mean, this is just an iteration of what are called the culture wars. If you want an analysis of that, or if you want an analysis about wokeness and so forth, then you'd want to read something else. Because this book is agenda-driven, it appeals to a base, and I think it is only presumably going to sell to a base. Give it a try and make your own mind up.
And that's it. Of course, you can make up your own mind about books. Maybe you will have a different view of Helen Zilla's book to the one that Jacques Rousseau had. You can be a reviewer and compare notes with the reviewers that we feature on the show. You can find any of these books nationwide at an exclusive bookstore nearby, or alternatively go to their website, exclusivebooks.co.za. You can look forward in 2 weeks' time to another edition of the show anchored by my co-host Joanne Joseph. And in the meantime, happy reading.